That's right. Thank you for coming in. I mean, you do a lot. We just had a short conversation before I turned the sort of the cameras on, and you've been doing a lot of traveling. So you definitely have a passion for getting involved in talent and digital economy. And you got a great background, and you definitely work in impact and international development. So thank you for coming in and sharing your time with us.
Thank you so much, Stephen, for having me today. I'm very excited about this conversation.
So Nasrat, what are the inflection points in your life? In other words, maybe when you were 4 or 5, or maybe when you were in early in school, could have been career-wise. There's always these turning points where it made you this, wonderful person you are today and this marvelous career you have. So what are those inflection points in your life?
I think it's there's probably three that come straight to the top of my head. The first one, around 8th grade of school, I grew up as a refugee in Pakistan. Originally, my mom and dad are Afghan, and so being a refugee, I had a passion for computers since I can remember. 8th grade, and there was a banner outside the school that said free Linux classes. And I looked at that, and I at that time was working on Windows, and I had always sort of heard my elder brother and a few people in that lab saying, Linux is hard, and it's sort of a different world than Windows. And so when I saw that, I was like, "Yeah, I'm gonna go and join these classes." They were offered by university. I think it was part of a computer program in Pakistan. It was probably funded by the UN. So anyway, I went to the university. And, I was like, hey, I want to get these classes. They were like, you're going to do Linux administration, or do you want to do like the operating system? And I said, I'll start with the operating system. I think it would be nice to know. And the guy was filling the form. He's like, do you know how to use a computer? I was like, yeah, I know how to use a computer. Very, and he was like, you're probably the youngest guy I've seen here come up. And so, and then he was like, give me your ID card. And I was like, well, I don't have an ID card, I'm a refugee. And he was like, well, I can't do it. Sorry, you can go. And so I was like, I'll just go to the class, you don't need to like enroll me. And I tried, but the guy got a little serious. And so I walked off. And going back, I think that plays such an important role in my life to think about that. Because every time I get a no, I go back certain times. I'm like, this is not the first time somebody said a no. And I also question a lot of the rules that are put in place. So maybe nowadays, if I'm talking to a VC or to a major UN institution, the rules are specifically made so, and it doesn't allow everyone to participate. And so I have respect for the rules, but I don't take them as they come. I think rules can bend. And then eventually, I also had to learn that, it's not necessarily a class that I'll have to learn Linux. I can go and learn it by myself through the community, and a ton of Yahoo search at the time.
So that's really fascinating. I mean, you're a refugee and you find out about this Linux class, and then you go to sign up and they ask for your ID and you don't have one because you're a refugee, right? And so so you end up learning it on your own. But I can see how that would shape what you do today, because you spend so much time in international development sectors or have. And your app is really about all of that as well, right? Inclusion and diversity and making sure that it can help people around the world. So what triggered, so how did you, so you, it seems like you're self-taught in Windows, then you self-taught in Linux. Did you take more formal training, or is it all self-taught, or what is that sort of educational path for you? You know, you could be like a Bill Gates or Mark Zuckerberg, right? Where they just learned it on their own. But you'd be under more difficult circumstances because you're like a refugee, right? So.
Yeah, so my path was pretty much all self-learning, but also individuals who taught me, not academic. So I finished refugee school around 9, 10, 11 grade of school. I did the Microsoft certification, so like MCP, MCSA, MCSE, and then the Cisco certifications, you know, CCNA, CCNP, and then a few Juniper certifications. And that was kind of how I got into internet working and doing routing protocols and just connecting, switching, routing mostly. And that was thanks to the really big vendors like Cisco and Microsoft, just kind of opening up their technology for new people to learn through these paths. Whereas having a CCIE was it's the Cisco's main networking exam. So a CCIE would be relevant pretty much to a master's degree. And so since we couldn't study in order to prove that we know a lot of refugees had to do like a certification from Microsoft. And so comparing a Microsoft certification to a university degree, a lot of people would be like, hey, it makes sense. You know, the person has that really high level certification. Yeah, but I never studied my undergrad, and I did end up working for quite a few major international development institutions, including the World Bank, UN, and USAID, and others. You certainly don't need a degree when you start your company. It's even better.
Yeah, I mean, the world has changed, right? It used to be that you needed some kind of additional post-secondary education, and that was sort of the gold standard. But now there's a shift. It's more skills-based, or you see both. You see people going sort of the academic route and then getting additional training by the company and so on. But there's also the skill-based path that a lot of people are taking as well, right? You know, where they get skills, and those skills could be measured and tested, and then they get hired and so on. And I know that Google has done studies on this, and they found that after an initial period of time, there's no difference. It's really the person. It's not based on the education they have. It's really based on the person. So let's say somebody gets a traditional degree, maybe they get a master's or something, and it could be from a school like MIT or Stanford. They have a head start, but then after a few years, it evens out, and then it's the person that determines how well they'll do ultimately, right? Because so it's interesting that kind of change that has occurred, but it isn't accepted. A lot of academic communities don't accept that yet. And which makes sense, right? Because it's you know, there's a whole economy based on that mindset. But then, you know, you have people who didn't go that route, like Bill Gates didn't go that route. He's self-taught, and largely self-taught, and Mark Zuckerberg is largely self-taught. So there's, you know, millions of people out there who are self-taught, and even more so now because there's just so much available on the internet where you can you know, learn on your own. So you basically just through the school of what we call hard knocks, just doing it, you've developed expertise. And like you said, you worked in the international development sector with the World Bank, with USAID, and the private sector for many, many years. And you became a systems infrastructure engineer by just doing it and learning and so on. But through your life, you've been featured by Time and NPR and a recipient of the Andrew Rice Award and Al Jazeera. How did that happen? How did you get featured by those really prominent organizations?
Yeah, I think coming back to the previous point, and that leads into this, is when you get a lot of rejection earlier on in your life and you're sort of outcast, that is obviously a lot of people don't make it through that mindset to be strong. So the confidence is built when somebody goes to Stanford. And the day they sort of graduate, that conversation is a very confident conversation. I've had a few of those where the normal thought process is, if I'm started a company, I'll go, apply for YC. If I'm studying, go study. If I'm working, apply to like JP Morgan. And that confidence is usually not there for people who are outcast, because of certain things in life. Now, a lot of that is like specifically being refugee is not something we chose. I was, really, really young, just a few weeks old. And so as you grow up, I think there might be a certain point where you don't let that rejections and the lack of resources and being poor sort of get internalized in a way. And so if you do cross it through that point, then I think you have even a lot more leeway than the Stanford graduates, because as they go through that process and start a company or they work in a large institution, obviously they're going to face issues through the time hurdles come in. And so the person that has had that practice for such a long time, they tend to succeed even more. But it's just that initial point. And I'm very passionate about that. I think kids, sort of refugees or people that are somehow limited by their surrounding, by external factors, they should be supported so that the playing field is level. Once the playing field is level, if somebody has that basic access to education, to the internet, to health, and that, peaceful mind, then they can choose whatever they want to do. So I think initially, in 2011, we had these TEDx in Kabul, in Afghanistan. I was soon as I grew up, I went back to Afghanistan, and my mission was to help Afghanistan and build my own country. And so I was very passionate, given that I was able to overcome those obstacles, including that Linux class. And there's probably, people don't really realize, but there's so many of these obstacles for refugees and usually people living like in underdeveloped countries. And so I was very confident. I went to do a TEDx talk, and somebody gave me that opportunity. And it kind of started from there, always outspoken, because there is such a big need. And then I try taking action, and I fail a lot of times, but the failure does not really affect me a lot because of how I grew up. And so it went on from there. And the different things that I've been involved in seems to be something that the media finds interesting. And also specifically when the government of Afghanistan collapsed more recently, my mindset was a lot more different than that of the international community. So thinking of August 15, which again, going to the first question, might also be one of those moments when I started thinking very differently, and it was the one of those pivotal moments, just like that Linux class. And so August 15, everyone, including the UN, World Bank, all the major institutions, everyone relevant enough was pulling out of Afghanistan. You could see the, people sort of dropping through the planes, and horrific, horrific scenes. I told my team at the time, we were 23 people in my company. I told them, we're gonna go back, and we're going to feed people, because the country went from having a government to not having a government, a banking system, everything pretty much collapsed around that day. So it seemed like it was everyone else was pulling out, and we were, expanding our operation. And people just found that very interesting, because everyone is trying to evacuate, and we are trying to expand our services. And that's happening at the same time. So not many people were expanding their services, which meant that ideally people would be interested in finding what is going on here.
That's a really compelling story. So, you have this refugee background. Because there's challenges and barriers, there's self-taught. There'd be bias as well. You'd have to counter bias, right? And that makes you strong. And that strength of overcoming challenges on a continuing basis is it gives you a foundation to help you succeed, right? Whereas, let's say, somebody goes to, one of the top schools, and they come from a professional family, and they're given a lot of advantages and opportunities along the way. Maybe they don't have to fight as hard, or the first time they may encounter a challenge is when they take their first job, and then they find, oh, gee, I mean, I have to really work and prove myself. And maybe that's the first time that they really, really had to prove themselves. And under a lot of different challenges, right? Because when you're working in business or in other areas, there could be a lot of upheavals that occur, especially today. The world's very chaotic. And yet you've done that your whole life. You've been in chaotic environments your whole life, and you've had to persevere. You've had to maintain your optimism. You've had to work really hard. And you had to sacrifice. And by doing so, you've been able to achieve success. And it's interesting that, so you work with these different international development sectors. You've self-trained and become a systems infrastructure engineer. And then you tell this, I mean, it's quite compelling though, but you start this company and people are pulling out, and yet you're pulling in. Because you think this is the time when people need my help the most and my company the most. So that's really, really quite fascinating. And then I can see why Time and NPR and others would spotlight you, because that's courage, that's hard work, it's perseverance, and you don't take no. A friend of mine, his name is Anthony Stefan, says that no is just a yes with conditions, or something to that effect, right? A no is yes with conditions. So there is really never a no, as long as you persevere and you stick at it, right? So, and you're really definitely an example of that. So tell me about why you started this company and what that company does and how you initially started it. And you said it's grown and where you are today. So what led you to start it? How did you start it? Because that's of interest to entrepreneurs out there, right? People who want to start a company, they're curious. So this gentleman started a company. How did he do that? What were the factors that allowed you to create a company? What do you think are the attributes of yourself and your team to be in a company to succeed? What are the things that allows a company to succeed? And then from that initial journey, you can describe where you are today. And then from there, you can describe what you hope to be in, let's say, 2 to 3 years. So how did you enter this journey as an entrepreneur? And I can relate because I'm an entrepreneur myself, a serial entrepreneur, right? And now I'm an investor as well, or have been an investor for a number of years. But so I understand that journey. But I'd like to get your perspective because you've done it under really hard and difficult conditions.
Yeah, I think I never had like a thought process of growing up and thinking that I will be an entrepreneur. I'll start a company maybe until sort of my mid-career, and I was working with the World Bank, but I always had this desire to make an impact for other people who were like me. And initially, I didn't know how you could do that effectively because the opportunities were not many. So I knew, given a refugee growing up, that I wanted to be in my own country because I mean, and this is also a little bit of a context is important because I currently live in the US. I live in DC, and we had a wave of refugees come in to the US, and they're treated very well, and they do very well, and they get a job by their second month, mostly. By the first month, they can do certain jobs that pay them. It is not the same when you go, for example, from Afghanistan to Pakistan, whereas the host country is underdeveloped, and there's also historic problems in that region. So I certainly knew that I wanted to help other refugees. I wanted to help Afghans. I wanted to help Afghanistan. And that was where I started. So I went back to Afghanistan and I started teaching. And this is the time where not a lot of people know English. I knew English, I knew computers. From there, it was just going uphill. I was an engineer, I was an IT manager. And then I was helping policy, sort of technical innovation and technology, telecom expansion, and stuff like that. Around the midway point, I started. So once you have some money, your family is fine, and you get out of that survival mode, I think one starts feeling of, hey, how can I be more effective? And then sort of came the clash between this institutional, large-scale international development thinking that I was part of, that whole ecosystem, and what I believe is the effective way of helping other people around the world. I had engaged with the UN, obviously thousands of employees in every organization of the UN and the World Bank and others. And what seemed like a good reason for them to have me, a very young guy who is very technical and can basically solve any IT problems that the older experts within these organizations have. That was the reason they hired me. Hey, this guy is very technical. He speaks very good English. And mostly the main reason, if my Excel doesn't work, if I need to design a data room for the Ministry of IT, this guy can really help that. Towards the midpoint of working with these institutions, I started asking questions. Hey, this is $100 million trade project that we are implementing for Central Asia, South Asia. Can we not get these artisans access to like an online platform? Amazon is there at this point. It's really big scale. Maybe we could try something like that. versus just getting these artisans, flying them on the plane and getting them to expos and spending $100 million in 5 years. It turns out, I was probably the only one thinking like that. And the idea then was, and this is pre-COVID, so every major international development institution nowadays is like tech focused, including the World Bank and others. And so it was the same reason they hired me. You're a technical guy. Now it was a problem, because they're like, well, this is too focused on technology. And I'm like, isn't that great? It would be easy to do that. And so that was sort of the point where I was like, hey, we're thinking of, and sadly, so based on what I as an individual, which is not that big of importance, but just to myself, is hey, it doesn't seem like we're taking the right steps to make sure that this country is going to be sustainable. And so to me, it was a big deal because I know how it feels to be a refugee. I know how it feels to be poor. I know how it feels to have to not have documents. But a lot of these experts, they come in from every other country. I've consulted for other countries too now. So it sort of started breaking up. I wasn't pumped to go to the office every day and work on this major project because there was a lot of backlash towards it. You're too high tech for us. You are too ambitious. You are too technical, right? And at that point, I started thinking about what would be the most effective way of doing this, and doing projects and then scaling them. And then I started to learn. I think one of the first few things was just knowing to go to Y Combinator and just go through the whole curriculum, and that's how my journey as an entrepreneur started. The simple idea of that I had was something that I was working on with a major institution at the time. Again, with trade, it was this idea of getting Afghanistan and the neighboring countries to be able to have the infrastructure to sell things. Turns out it's not just the major institutions who think like that, it's also the major tech companies that think like that. So the Amazons and the Etsys of the world think underdeveloped countries are a liability. It's a risk factor for them. I mean, thinking of Etsy is, which in some ways is our competitor. They sell handmade products, but they only are operational in, I think, the 20 most developed economies of the world. It doesn't make sense because handmade creation of handmade items happens where the labor costs are low, people don't have much to do, and they create those handmade items. It's mostly in underdeveloped countries. So Etsy should have been designed for the people that make the most handmade items, but because of certain perceived concepts which go both way, they have missed the mark. And so then I thought, we'll create the infrastructure, supply chain and a fintech infrastructure, and we'll start with a few vendors and then we'll expand that. And so our initial mission was to create 10,000 jobs in Afghanistan with the handmade marketplace of Asil. And we were doing pretty amazing until the country collapsed. At that point, then we didn't stop. We called the handmade part buy good, and we started a humanitarian side, which is do good. Then again, I mean, GoFundMe is the world's biggest emergency platform, and they don't support the world's biggest emergencies. So it's only available, I believe, in 16, 17 of the highest developed countries. And so that brought us to this understanding of what does it take It's mostly the supply chain and the fintech infrastructure. If these two can be provided, then you will have the other side of the economy that is not included in this digital party that we all have, to enable them to join us. And that's 3 billion people, and they all do have the same value of life as all of us in the West.
So I can see now the motivation, right? You're in these big international development organizations, and the mindset is more traditional. We'll take these artisans, we'll actually fly them to different locations, and that's sort of the thinking that used to be pervasive around the world, right? And I could see that also in the many years that I've been interfacing with UN agencies over a period of time. There's this kind of older thinking. But now a transition has happened. And you're on the inside saying, no, we could use technology, we could leverage that, we could make it give accessibility to everyone, right? Because it's low cost, it scales easily. And there's a resistance, so you do it on your own. And now the world has changed, right? The world is more accepting of this concept, and so on. So you decide to create this company that can work with artisans and help sell the goods, and it has a humanitarian side as well. You were able to even accelerate what you did during the collapse that occurred in Afghanistan. So that's an unusual story. Even during the collapse, you were able to accelerate what you were doing. You've expanded into Turkey, for example, and so on. How did you get a team together? I mean, how did you attract people to become part of your company? How did you pay them? How did you attract investment? I mean, how did you fund this thing? Because initially there's no income coming in, and yet you've got to build infrastructure, you got to build the tech, you got to build the supply chain, and so on. I mean, how did you do all of that? And then now that you've been doing it for a bit, what are the attributes you think made you and your team succeed? And you can share that with the audience because they'd be curious, what are the success factors for entrepreneurs? So how did you still, you got this idea and it's an operation, but how did you even get it into operation? Excuse me.
Yeah, so I think in terms of what happened, and so I had been working for a long time. We live in Afghanistan. There's not a lot of expenses. As a young guy, you can't do much. You don't. You live in, mostly Afghans still have the culture. We live in a big house with a big family. It's all joint families, and so there wasn't a lot of expenses. So I lived very scrappy, and I didn't like spending a lot of money. I didn't need to. The only thing I had was this sort of thirst for travel, and that was something because, again, Afghans and other underdeveloped countries, it is a very small, limited amount of countries you can travel to visa free. Certainly can't go to the West because they're not going to grant you visas. And so that was my only expense for a long time, to be able to travel. I saved a lot of pretty much everything I had. And towards that midpoint, I decided, hey, I'm going to have a company. I think it's efficient way of doing what I'm planning to do. So I knew I needed to save money. The initial investment that I had It was all my savings that I had. I took out my pension as well, and I put that mostly. I would travel, so there's the underdeveloped element where we're building infrastructure and then connecting it to the Western sort of digital economy side of things. There's a lot of travel testing how to do addressing within these countries, how to create a supply chain. What is the best way of sending money to people? And so there was a lot of travel. I initially kept a very lean team. It was just me. I called upon my brother, who is an engineer, and a couple of other peoples from my students that I had. And then I couldn't afford to bring in, people, engineers that I would have liked, and so I announced this program called the JP, the Junior Professionals within ASEAN. And so the Junior Professionals, and I have a belief that you can get young people, and you start with like a clean canvas. You can tell them, teach them certain things, certain way, and they do it like that. The good thing with really experienced engineers is that when you engage with them, if they have worked in an environment where things are done really nicely, or in other ways, the way we do it, I guess, then it's good. But they all come with their own thought process, and sometimes they're not good. You pay them a lot, and they have their own way of doing things, which is mostly hard when you have a six people company because it's very clear that you don't agree. And so the Junior Professional Program mostly was at the time, 2018 and 19. I hired around 25 young people, aged between 18 to 22, and I trained them through this 2 years program. And obviously, everything that was physical, vendor onboarding, photography, things like that, they love doing that, and they're very energetic to do that compared to an experienced person. And then most of the product development, I knew that I could train them on that. So at some point, what ASEAN within my friends' community would be like the ASEAN University. And they would bring in people, junior professionals. We trained them for 2 years. And within those 2 years, they were mostly taught the entrepreneurship, the YC sort of book of how you do things. And then on the engineering side, mostly, the highest level of how you could do it. And I would always challenge them to not think traditionally or compete with local companies in that region. And even here now, I'm in Turkey, just traveling here. I still keep that mindset to make sure that you look at Airbnb, you look at Uber. You look at Instacart as something you want to compare yourself with. And it's very easy to tell a 20 years old guy, hey, look at how Airbnb does that, and let's think and discuss how we can do that. Then a 40 years old engineer who has been working in another sort of company, the first thing they will tell you is, hey, listen, we're not Airbnb. And I don't like that at all because we're people. And you don't really need that physical cash and investment to make a software company. You need good quality code. And so I think the junior professionals played a major role. A really huge problem that I initially had, and our startup still sort of has that, is when you don't have that Stanford or YC or JP Morgan stamp, and you have a startup, then you're coming from, you're servicing people that are not part of the digital economy, the thought process is either A, it's a bit too risky, or your operations in Afghanistan, for example, huge red flag initially, and just the team, when they look at the team and there's nobody who is there from Stanford or all of these big tags. Maybe I'm probably the only one. I have World Bank, which is not good for investors. It becomes a very big challenge. And so I think there's a lot of education that has to happen to the investors from the entrepreneur. You have to educate them on why this is important. So simply put, we think that underdeveloped countries are a huge, huge, huge opportunity because these systems do not exist. And if you create these systems, which are not that hard, because we have done it and here is the traction to prove that, then you're basically, by being in developed markets, making more Western-focused products, you are competing against these resources where really huge institutions for this limited resources, whereas getting to underdeveloped countries is easier. People are more patient with you. We know that if the shops that were the handmade vendors, artisans, and the people we feed give them food, they are more patient with us than customers in more developed markets. And so I think for investors to realistically think and get to a point, obviously, before somebody writes a check, there's a lot of thought process and they really have to believe you. For a person to really believe that, Afghanistan or other underdeveloped countries are not in a great situation, but we're not going to take you there physically. And we're going to make sure that these specific compliance related things are taken care of. But now let me tell you that that opportunity is bigger than this, what you're looking at mostly in the developed market. And then the only thing you have to prove at that point is that you are the guy that's going to do it, or you are the girl that's going to do it. And that, I guess, is a game of how long do you know a person? I always tell my friends, entrepreneurs, to not really go out and pitch to start with. And I don't think it's the best. I think usually if I know somebody who's my friend for a week and he or she asks me for money, I'd be like, I don't think so. But if I know somebody for a longer time, I'm like, okay, first time so-and-so is asking me for money, probably needs it, and small amount, okay, good. Yeah, gives it back to me or whatever. And so it's important to know the right people, build that relationship, let them know you, and then go on. At least, obviously there's these companies that have this, we're going to do seed, we're going to do Series A, we're going to do Series B, I will exit. I'm not mainly referring to those because the starting point for entrepreneurs like me and others that are mostly passionate about the problem is not about the exit. Yes, the financial exit for the investors and me, I want to make sure that happens, but it's not about, it's a responsibility and it's this hard work that I'll build this company and then I will exit and then I will go and be happy. It doesn't work in the context of big ideas that are going to change the world, especially the most problematic, which is the underdeveloped world. And this is also in terms of investment for institutions, not just a private investor. The institutions would also love to see your track record and then commit to it. The best is to, when you do create a product, is to go out and create something to find maybe 3 out of 100 people that genuinely back you up because of the idea and the work you have done. And then you need to know that the 97 others will come up once they feel like they are missing the train. And they will all come in. Every single no is a yes, as you mentioned, in due time with the conditions. And they will all hop on this train if you do well. So that's how I think about it. And I know it feels like money is not the number one motivation here, but realistically, successful companies are built this way, from what I have studied, from my experience.
Yeah, I mean, you gave a really sort of thoughtful and nuanced answer to the question. I mean, you're constrained in terms of financing, so you self-financed and you saved up money, and that's and you recruited younger people because they're more willing to take on any kind of initiative, and because you taught for many years as well, you taught technology, then you became a mentor teacher to young people who you onboarded into your company. And because they're a tabula rasa, a blank slate, you can help to mold and mentor them into the right way of doing things, to be very much more open to ideas, because they don't come sort of pre-conditioned in a particular way, and so on. So, and that gives you flexibility. That keeps your burn rate. There's this term called the burn rate, which is like the amount of money you use each month to keep your company going. Keeps it very low, and you're providing a service too, because you're training people. It's like you're giving them a private education for 2 years, the 2 years that you put them through this program. It's a very thoughtful approach, and one that takes into consideration that you're working in an area that's not as developed as other areas, right? So you're trying to make it another friend of mine calls it an omni win, as Mark Sadovnik calls it an omni win. You win, but they win as well. And it's a partnership, right? Rather than they're not an employee, they're a partner in this journey. That's interesting. So where are you today? And you also mentioned that, it's not about the financial aspect. It's more than that, right? It's much broader. It's a return on value, not a return on investment. There's this idea of return on investment, and this idea of a financial investor where you just want to invest just to get some kind of return. And there's this more broader concept of return on value, where you as the entrepreneur, but people who invest as well, they invest for a return to the broader stakeholders involved, and not just the financial return. And ultimately, if you have a bigger vision in that way of return on value, ultimately you'll have a better chance of success, right? Because you're providing a multi-stakeholder approach to a value return, where everybody wins, right? So I understand where your kind of your motivation, how you got there. I'm trying to reword it in sort of my perspective of what you said. And then, so where are you today? I mean, how many people do you have in your company? I know in your bio you talk about you're in Afghanistan, you're in Turkey as well, so how are the operations going? Because people have this sort of image of Afghanistan as a very difficult area to work in, and yet you have an operation there, and then also in Turkey. And Turkey, of course, doesn't have some of the sort of the challenges of being in conflict for many years, and that sort of infrastructure is there in Turkey, right? I mean, they're part of NATO, I believe, right? So, and they're part of they're part of all of these sort of more established Western kind of economies and so on. So
Yeah,
where
I
are you
think
today?
Turkey's location is a huge win, just naturally for this country, where it is so beautiful, and it's just in that middle of the world. We were in Turkey, we're in Afghanistan, the two countries. I think our thought process is shaped throughout this last 5, 6 years. As a company, is we don't think of ourselves as a startup that will go through these certain stages in certain years. We think it's a long marathon, and we will keep on growing regardless of, hey, this is our Series A round, and we will go 18 months, and we will have X amount of money, and by this time we will raise again. We think it makes sense in Silicon Valley when the idea is created for that mission that's there. But our mission is different. We look at the world as, 3 billion people don't have access to the digital economy, and they don't have access to the digital economy because of supply chain and fintech infrastructure. So we know what it will take for these countries to have that infrastructure. It has to be custom built. It's the same story of how the internet expanded to the parts of the world that it did, and why it doesn't expand to the rest of that last mile, 10% of the people that will never have access, because this formula applied to 70% of the world. Then we tried this formula for the 20% more, which was hard, and we did it. And then this 10% is always left behind. And we think they could be great internet users as well, just like this. And so we think that 3 billion people don't have access to the digital economy. These are the two reasons: the supply chain and the fintech infrastructure. And we know that even if Amazon and Etsy and all these major platforms wants to go to these countries, they will have to create their own custom supply chain and fintech infrastructure. So we're taking our time to start with, but we will expand really fast once we know that this is what really works. We know what works in Afghanistan. We know what works in Turkey. Now we're further expanding that. And once that's done, we'll go to 7 more countries and then go to all the 46 underdeveloped countries. From there on, and there's always this debate of, maybe we should also then attack and get the Western market. But we will see about that. So, for instance, in terms of the do-good part of ASEAL, which is humanitarian, a big issue is addressing. And so we look at the GPS, change it to words. There's plugins. What 3Word has done it a long time ago. We do internal, mechanisms of doing that, and now we know it works. And we could get things from our vendors and on top of a mountain and send it to somebody in California, and that's beautiful. It works. The person in California wants to pay a lot more than what the vendor charges, and so we know we're going to use that in other countries as well. And it would be very hard for other people to then come in and easily get rid of us, even if they have a lot of money, unless we sell the company. And so at that point, they will have to do their own infrastructure, because this is what it takes. And we are already ahead of the game. So we think, rather than creating solutions for an already saturated market in the Western part of the world, if we're able to take this 3 billion people as an opportunity, we will have a major, we would have hit a major jackpot. And the people who are working on these solutions, and it's not ASEAL, there is many other companies doing similar work. They work very hard. They don't have a specific exit. I'm still very lucky because I live in the US. We are a US-based C Corp, so I have access to these certain things. Think of other countries where people don't have that. So I think we look at that as a value, and we're going to keep on expanding. The reason we've been a bit slow, so we categorize Afghanistan as a 0 or 1 out of 10 in the digital economy participation. And then we came to Turkey because we categorize that as a 5 out of 10. And then the US might be a 10 out of 10 or a 9. So we wanted to test with these two. We have amazing success. And hopefully within the next couple of years, we'll try opening up and going to more countries. We think right now is the time to really learn and what really works before we bring in a lot of money, a lot of investors. We know this is not a financial problem. You can throw money at this, but you will still need to sit down very critically, bring the right people together who understand this, and build that solution. We know once we build that solution, so like vendor onboarding was a major problem. People don't know how to use the internet, they don't know English, and you want their products to be on your platform. So we brought in a refactored sort of TaskRabbit, where we have the gig economy now. People are going onboarding vendors and they get paid for it. They are adding products with such amazing quality photos and really good text, and they get paid for it. Every time we get an order, and it needs to be, specifically packed in a way, that level of customer service is given by another guy. That guy has an app which is called the Heroes platform. So can we have thousands of heroes and add every single product in Afghanistan into the platform? We estimated that it would take us around 210 days to add every single platform, every single handmade item throughout the whole country with the help of this. So we know that now, and we can scale that very easily. And so, yeah, our aim is to support those 3 billion people, obviously making sure we help Afghanistan. And we also responded to the Turkey earthquake and with our Heroes Network. And so we think once we get to that 46 countries, then the upside that is unlimited. This is not a specific market, a specific company for a specific solution. This is a company that looks at a very big problem, and it might take us 20 years. But what have I got better to do? I don't think so. So we'll keep on doing this, and hopefully contribute to that mission. And in the way, there is a lot of inspiration when you deal with problems as such. So I'm very happy, and everyone I work with is very happy. They get paid to feed people, and that's great.
So I can see your journey then. I can see your journey from the refugee camps to becoming an infrastructure engineer, and you taught it, and then thinking about having a company. And I can see the stages of your start of your company, your startup, and how you've expanded, and how you've been able to optimize and increase efficiencies within this program. And you're now a C Corp in the US, but you have these, it's an international company, right? And there's advantages if you're constituted in the US, right? So, I mean, it's an interesting journey. I'm just conscious of time. Did you have a hard stop at 7:30 Pacific, or?
Yeah, no, I have 20 more minutes. I can stay.
So, because we went over, it's a fascinating journey, and there's a lot of lessons that people can learn from listening to you, and because you're very thoughtful in your approach, right? And very methodical, and I can understand it as well. So, I just have maybe a few more questions. So we talked about your journey and how you started this company and what were the reasons why. You got introduced to me through the Knowledge Impact Network. So how did you get involved with this community called the Knowledge Impact Network? And by the way, for the audience, it's a community of people who mentor and support and provide knowledge, and there's like over 1,000 in that community, and they help. The purpose of the it's a nonprofit. The whole purpose is people help others, right? So there's a lot of CEOs in there or people who had a lot of success, and then they try to help those who are still in that journey, whatever that journey is, or a challenge that they're trying to support in some particular area. And then they want to reach out to a broader community of people who have knowledge, and then they can share that knowledge or their networks or and so how did you get involved with the Knowledge Impact Network? Who onboarded you into the Knowledge Impact Network?
So I think Knowledge Impact Network is a bunch of people that are genuinely interested in seeing how the development sector can be treated differently, and how social impact can play sort of a different role. And given that they bring in people from mostly broader, bigger institutions, it's very interesting to them how Asil, for instance, is looking at this very different than others. So I think that was their main interest in Asil. From our end, I think we are always same, as Ken, very interested in finding people who are part of bigger institutions. There's a lot of YPOs there. There is some attachment to the Harvard community and others. And they're in our interests align per se. We like them because they have these associations with larger institutions, but their main target is to really understand how people like us do what we do. And so we're not very, very, open. And let's say our primary target is not to go out there and deal with these broader, bigger institutions that are, trying to do things the way they are doing and require more budget or more resources. So think of like the World Food Program in Afghanistan. When this emergency happened, their first response was, "Hey, we need $5.2 billion to respond to this." Whereas our response was, "Well, let's go out, help people, and what is the most efficient way to feed 10 people and then feed 100 people and then feed 1,000 people and then keep on feeding more people?" And so it is not so much about if we have X billion dollars, we will connect X million people. It's more to do with, how can we connect one people, 10 people, 100 people, and once we do that, then we can scale forward. So I think that's something that I really liked about the Knowledge Impact Network. And from the way we got connected with them is just very random. One of our social media specialists, I think she's 20 years old, reached out to me on Slack and said, "Hey, let's try to check these guys out." And I was like, "All right, I'll go." And I put the application, and then I had a call with them, and they brought in like seven people from different areas, somebody from, I think, Deloitte, somebody from San Francisco. We all sat down and they looked at Asil, and they gave us quite a few important feedback on. At the time, we were doing a sort of bridge investment round right after the government of Afghanistan had collapsed. And so they gave us good feedback, and Elaine is amazing. She gives us input from time to time, and we really love them. There's also many other communities like that that we reach out to. If I think about one, it was the Extreme Tech Challenge. We just applied for it, and I went to Japan, and we won that in Japan. And that was really interesting to me. Get into a place where I was probably one of the three or four people from the other countries. Everyone is Japanese, and we're not winning this because nobody will relate. And then we did, and it was very, very interesting. We also joined the MIT Solve Challenge. We were semifinalists in that, Village Capital. I think that's a big lesson for entrepreneurs is, keep on reaching out to other people. It doesn't have to be these big guys, these VCs. Talk to other people, send a very minor application, doesn't cost much. You might be in Japan and winning a competition, and that opens doors. And it gives you a very different perspective because had we had, say, I don't know, Sequoia or Kamen when we just had the concept note, we would have not built an awesome company. I would have went to California, sit there for 5 years, keep building, and maybe it would have been more profitable, easier, but solving these complex problems are not easy for a reason. And if you don't go through these hurdles, you wouldn't know the root problem, and you wouldn't be able to really solve them. Making patches eventually is not going to enable those 3 billion people to onboard the digital economy.
That's fascinating. It just comes to mind then you could apply for the Innovation Factory for AI for Good. So there's a UN agency called the ITU. They're really old. They're like 160 years old, almost 160. They're definitely technology focused. They actually have a $30 billion Partners Connect program to bring on the remaining people who are not connected to the net, internet. And they've been so I believe they've got committed over $30 billion to that program now. But they have this program called AI for Good, and they have an innovation program called the Innovation Factory, and it's free. It's an open platform. You compete, and they have let's say every few weeks they'll have a contest, and they have judges, and they select a winner, and then at the end of the year, and now they've been doing this at AI for Good, they actually have a grand finale, and where you get a lot of exposure, and there's some prizes and things like that. Though there is a requirement, you have to have some AI in there somewhere, right? So some analytics
Yeah, I
AI,
think
and so.
everyone needs to hop on and bring in some kind of AI into their companies because it would be a waste if you don't. I think the least is we need to expedite our development, and that's very important. You don't need to. I think if anyone within tech companies don't use ChatGPT, it's a bad idea. They should, especially developers, because we have a lot of code. Back in the days, a lot of our developers are Afghan and from that region, India and others who don't really get that opportunity to work with Google or Microsoft. And so the way that they do their development would not be as efficient. And now you just give that code to ChatGPT and say, hey, can you how would a Google engineer write this? And then you get the response that is actually pretty amazing to have a Google engineer by your side at all times. So yeah, we do have some internal epics within our sprints, that is mostly focused on AI. And we also want to make sure that women specifically in Afghanistan were not allowed to pursue education or work in offices, are able to, go straight to doing something in the AI space. Because they have the internet, they have their computers, and we give them solar panels. And so this is a huge opportunity. I'm big on AI.
There's a company called Beebox, and they've grown quite a bit. They're a unicorn, or heading trading to be a unicorn, and they're in many countries now. They also give out solar panels, including all of the digital infrastructure for our community. And what it does is it allows that community then to get like heating devices and lighting, and they can then get a bike or some kind of vehicle, and it's all because they set up this solar cell storage facility to, and it basically empowers them with electricity, and then from that they can then do commerce, and they develop a financial profile. And then they can buy things. And it's a company called Beebox. I think you'd be interested in meeting with. I'm just kind of brainstorming live with you. Happy to do an introduction. I know the founder. And maybe there's some way you two can collaborate, because you've got some of the things that they're doing as well. They definitely are impact-minded. They're in Africa. That's where they started. And now they're in, many, many countries, and they've scaled. In fact, they're one of the top energy companies now in the world, I would say, right? So, and then the Innovation Factory, it's an open platform. Why not apply, right? There's no risk and everything to gain. But we've been sort of talking for almost an hour and a half. So I'll just add one more question, and that is, what final recommendations would you like to leave the audience?
Well, I think one recommendation I have is think deeply about what you think is a problem. We look at problems and we label them as problems, but most of the time they're opportunities.
Right.
I think that's one very important lesson that I've learned. And I think every single time I've sort of went out there initially, pitch a seal to somebody, and they would really think, laugh at you. Like, you could create an e-commerce marketplace in the US. Why do you need to go to Afghanistan? And part of, I think, what makes brilliant entrepreneurs brilliant ideas is just this idea that, you don't really have to do it yourself. I'm pitching the startup to you, so you can let me do it, right? And think of anything that's amazing, like electric cars, software, going to space, everything that's there that might seem crazy, that might seem problematic, there is somebody who can, do that, and it would be one of the biggest opportunities out there. And then one personal recommendation is to engage a lot more in countries that need assistance, specifically Afghanistan. More recently, we have had the issues in Ukraine and now in Palestine and Israel. And I think we might think a lot of things are out of our hand, but any kind of engagement, if it's doing a donation, if it's finding a platform that can help, if it's knowing somebody that you met in a conference and just reaching out and saying, "Hey, how can I help?" A lot of us are not happy in the Western world, but we think these problems are so big, but doing small things and reaching out is probably one of the best returns on investment in terms of feeling great. And once you feel great, you can do a lot of good stuff that day.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. Problems are opportunities to learn, and problems are opportunities to find solutions, right? And a lot of learning comes from addressing problems and being mindful of how you address them. And then, like you said, stepwise. I mean, I used to teach logic, right? And programming logic, and a big sort of pillar. Many, many years ago, I guess when I used to teach was programming logic was stepwise refinement. In other words, if you have a really big problem, you break it down into small steps, right? And by then, you can solve any kind of problem. So this idea of always reaching out to someone you met at a conference, or it takes one step at a time. One person at a time. And that's what Ken's kind of modeling, right? You just reach out, and just by reaching out to one other person or two other people, that can create a movement. And in fact, I was the MC at a CEO conference, and one of the guest speakers indicated, and this is now backed up by research, that 3.5%. If you can get 3.5% of any community involved, you can create a movement. You can do systemic change. So 3.5% could be in your village. It could be in your block. It could be in your school. It could be in your family. You know what I mean? So, or it could be a nation, or it could be the world, right? 3.5% is doable, and it starts with one person at a time. So Nazra, thank you for coming in. Really interesting, engaging journey you're on, and I can see how you will attract attention and followers. Again, thank you for sharing so much with my audience.
Thank you so much, Stephen, for this opportunity to talk to you. And I'm sure I will see you soon.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.